Hey, everybody. Welcome to the American Horror Story podcast on Bald Move, the officially unofficial podcast for American Horror Story 1984 on the FX Network. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Cecily.
And today we're talking about Season 9, Episode
3.
Am
I?
we'll have a complex interwoven flashback reveal middle of this podcast, don't you worry. But right now we're still in Episode 9, Season 3, talking about Slashdance. Holy shit, this is a lot.
You mean Season 9, Episode 3, but I think they understood.
What did I say?
You said Season 3, Episode 9.
Season 1984, Episode 3, Slashdance. This was a really fun episode.
It was great.
Also, like,
time just flew by, this one.
A lot of the stuff that we made, well, first of all.
Except, you know, during the actual night that we're seeing.
Yeah, we're settling in for the night. You know, we're right in Episode 3. It's still the first night.
It's about 8 p.m.
At first, we were kind of anxiety riddled by how long the night is. But now it's like, it's cozy. It's comfortable.
Yeah.
We're getting to know its contours. This night's going real well.
Is there a pre-existing phrase for, you know, comedy torture is where something is unfunny for so long that it becomes funny?
Yes.
Is there a pre-existing phrase for that in this particular thing?
In this genre? I think it's called Ryan Murphy.
Like tension torture?
Tension torture. It's funny because even though there's a lot of like the same shit that AHS does with the flashbacks, it kind of, some of the flashbacks and some of the weird stuff actually fill in some of the more bizarre behaviors from people that we've seen before.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, sure, you use 16 flashbacks to do it, but because it's almost like the writers on American Horror Story baited us to just think, oh, this is the same stupid shit we're always going to get every season.
Mm-hmm.
And this third episode, they're like, ha ha, fooled you. We actually have explanations for all this stuff.
We got new stupid shit
but
for
they're
you.
Doing, yeah, they're using the other some of the other stupid AHS tricks to do it. So mm-hmm. I don't know.
But for some reason, it feels different this time.
Yeah.
I feel like with this sort of this campy genre that you can get away with doing all the things that they're doing.
Yeah.
And it's so much fun. Where when you get a story like Apocalypse, when you try to do this stuff, it doesn't really work as well.
Yeah, Apocalypse is too... tried to get too close to being like high fantasy
or like season two Asylum. I love that season, but it didn't work when you start throwing in shit like aliens,
right? Yeah.
Coen Brothers style.
No, I mean that's AHS in a nutshell. Like,
but this is working.
If you look at the elephant's trunk, it's a perfectly good trunk. You feel the elephant's leg, it's a perfectly good leg. You feel the elephant's tail, it's a fine tail. But you look back at the hole and you're like, what the fuck is this thing? I'm not sure if that analogy actually works in service of what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is, like, any given AHS season feels to me like there's two or three or sometimes even four parts that work like as individual arcs. But when they try to mash them together into one container that is the season, it's like, oh God, there's problems here.
Right. And this is only episode three. So
we're only episode. So
we're
yeah,
setting ourselves up for failure now.
This is the long night, and I'm sure it's going to be a perfectly fine satire of 80s slasher flicks.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be scary once we get to the conclusion of the long night, because who knows what'll happen?
Who knows?
But it's super fun right now.
Yeah. I'm having a great
time.
The little
chubs, but it's super cute. Do we want to say anything else, or should we get right into the episode?
Let's get into the episode, starting with the title. I think we've forgotten to talk about the actual title of the episode the past couple of episodes.
Slashdance.
Slashdance. What do you think this means?
Can I confess something?
Please.
I've never seen Flashdance.
I have seen...
My strict religious upbringing considered that movie subversive and sexual and forbidden for mm-hmm. some reason. That and Footloose. I haven't seen Footloose either.
She's still a working girl trying to weld her way to a dance career.
A woman is working outside the home? Well, yeah. There you go. Subversive as fuck.
Really,
was
really
she wearing
is.
A head covering at least?
She was.
Okay.
She was being very safe.
That's pretty liberal. But it might have been allowed. If I could go back in time and explain that to my mom.
Yeah, there's a scene where she demonstrates the use actually of like a safety apparatus that would put out a fire if any of your clothes or materials were to catch.
See, I showed that my mom that scene. I was arguing that she's being very clean.
Right.
She just like it's like, you know, she felt dirty. She had to have a shower.
Very wholesome movie.
Yeah, that's like, and you know, cleanliness next to godliness.
So we've gotten on a tangent. This episode, Slashdance, I guess it takes you know, it takes its name from slasher flicks. And then Flashdance came out in 1983, so a year before this is happening. That's culturally relevant.
The Flashdance, other than like the leggings,
a lot of there's a lot of slashing going on in this episode.
There's a lot of slashing, but I'm saying Flashdance. What's the Flashdance? Was like,
I don't know. Just it's a fun wordplay.
Okay, okay.
You're thinking too hard about it.
Well, I haven't seen Flashdance. I'm fighting with both hands tied behind the microphone here.
Clearly.
Before we get back to the episode, I want to talk a little housekeeping here for Bald Move. Cecily and I, in addition to American Horror Story, are doing our scary movie podcast, the annual Cinematic Spooktacular 3, The Search for Spook. This week, we're discussing the movie Spring, Brightburn, and the classic 1978 John Carpenter slasher flick, Halloween. Also, Jim and I did a preview podcast for Mr. Robot, whose final season starts this weekend. And you know, we'll have complete coverage of every episode every Wednesday. You can find that by searching for 2-Bit Encryption in your favorite podcast. Why not subscribe today? Also, our Rick and Morty coverage rolls on. This week, we covered the Season 3 episode, Vindicators 3, The Return of World Ender. We also talked to Danielle Radford, writer for Screen Junkies' Honest Trailers, as well as Maximum Fun's wrestling podcast, Tights and Fights, about superheroes in the Rick and Morty universe. And tomorrow, we're seeing the Joker movie that everyone's talking about. Will it live up to the buzz? Will it destroy Western civilization? Find out. That review will be in our Bald Movies feed.
We're moving on to the first thing that happens, which is the Night Stalker tries breaking into the infirmary. Boy, does he. Tries various doors, various windows. I felt like it was kind of like a Romero zombie flick, where they're just barricading themselves into these flailing arms from the outside, moaning and groaning.
Yeah.
Finally, Nurse Rita finds her keys, and they plan to bail, except Ray, who we're going to find out this character turns out just has zero moral fiber and is a complete spineless coward.
He's a real piece of shit.
Yeah,
that Ray.
So he's like, there's four of us. I'm pretty sure I'm faster than two of you, and I'm boning out.
What makes him a genuine asshole is that it's just it's unmotivated. It's unprompted.
Yeah.
His assholery sometimes.
Well, I mean, they're going to prompt it with a series of nesting flashbacks. Don't you worry. So he tries to run out the back door, except for Night Stalker kicks down the back door and just cuts Ray up real vicious. Chet, even though Ray just announced that he was going to abandon them all to their fate, feels bad for leaving him getting cut up like that and goes and just hands Ramirez his ass and helps Ray up. Keep in mind now for the rest of the episode that Ray's arms are shredded and not in like the Trevor sense of the word.
No, the very important forearm, like driving and climbing muscles.
Yeah, all the complex tendons.
Did you count how many slices he got?
Seven slices.
Seven slices to his important forearms with a very sharp hook knife.
Yes. A gut knife.
Nice guy, Chet.
Nice guy, Chet.
He gets a little angry sometimes, but...
He's going to... Yeah, well, this is the... So everyone knows about the roid rage.
Oh, and...
Everyone knows about the roid rage, but it's a lesser known side effect, the roid empathy.
Right.
So, you know, when you're down cycle, it's
severe mood swings, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I just remembered that Ray has a pretty severe cut to his palm that he received... 5 minutes ago, 30 minutes ago,
right.
Within the last hour.
Eight slashes to his hand, his arms and hand.
A sliced palm, yeah.
Lots of defensive wounds going on here already.
Also, in this general scene, we see, I wanted to point this out, though it won't be relevant for long. We see that Nurse Rita goes and finds her keys immediately. Do you think she's...
in on things? Yes.
No,
yeah,
no,
after
no.
This episode.
No, I just didn't even think about this before now, but do you think Nurse Rita is genuinely scared by Ramirez? Like, she didn't expect that. She thought Mr. Jingles was going to attack the infirmary.
Oh, no, you're right.
And then,
she pretended
didn't know where her keys were, and then she immediately found them.
As soon as they found out it was Ramirez.
Yeah.
She's like, how
she's
many,
like,
you know,
oh, no,
like,
fuck this.
This isn't Jingles. This is some other fucking asshole. Yeah,
right.
You're right. One other thing. If you want, just for fun, and since it's early in the episode, pay attention to the continuity of Ray's clothes.
Because
there's
a few
times where the editors clearly were trying to build tension by inserting extra scenes because Ray's clothes go from like pristine to bloody to pristine to bloody.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it's kind of the same thing in Star Wars where they rock the sand person back and forth to give him a little bit of tension there.
Yeah.
Same basic principle. So
spotting those.
Xavier over in the dorm cabins is screaming that this is fate or karma coming to get them all, as Mr. Jingles is apparently trying to get in their cabin. He breaks their windows and flings a flaming bag of shit at them. So Trevor puts it out, gets shit covered. They rush out the cabin to find several teenagers dressed as Mr. Jingles and wishing them a happy Jingles Day. Which is a thing in this community.
Right. That nobody knew about. Well, yeah. I guess that kind of makes sense.
I mean, these people wouldn't.
It's been 14 years. Nobody, only the locals would really know. The townies.
But wouldn't, like, the chef know? Like, wouldn't she have kept up on the thing? I don't know. It's whatever. Like, a local festival celebrating a serial killer, why not?
How old do you think these guys are?
I think they're supposed to be high schoolers.
You think so?
But they looked like early 20s.
Yeah.
Twenties. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. Montana has a great line here. She goes, I could use one of those lewds right about now.
Yeah. Just to like, you know, even her out, right?
Yeah. I remember to take my lewds this morning.
Which is funny in retrospect because this is another situation where she has been fucking with Brooke this whole time because at the end of the episode, we know, right? That her and Montana.
Let's save it to the end because I have questions.
This is another situation where, like, I think she was, like, chilled out until she found out that this is a Jingles guy. Like, this Jingles guy is real. So,
yeah.
You know, she was expecting a serial killer to come, just not this one.
Right.
It's fun. It's fun. Yeah. They broke a sweat in the writer's room for this segment. So in the run through the woods, Chet and Ray fall into a punji pit, which if you didn't know is a pit that you dig, and you fill its bottoms full of wooden stakes, and you really give someone a bad day to fall in.
And you catch some college kids.
And this is some games the GIs played with the Viet Cong in the jungles of Nam, apparently, as popularized and culturally by Rambo. Ray somehow missed all the stakes, but Chet wasn't so lucky and took one through the shoulder. Nurse Rita at the top of the pit with Brooke says we shouldn't wait for them. Oh, no, they don't know that this happened. They just hear him scream and say we shouldn't wait. We got to run to the lot. There's this bizarre scene of the real Mr. Jingles confronting this kind of loser dressed up Jingles that's obviously the butt of the other Jingles jokes.
Super fan.
He's got like a twisted urethra.
He's got a lot going on.
Incredibly nearsighted to the point he can't even tell that the Jingles is the real Jingles. He's got a bad case of asthma. And
so, I mean, he's doing the most of a certain type of character that you're supposed to find repugnant and pathetic.
Yes.
And including his parents paying what I wrote down and interpreted as adult men to take him out vandalizing to emulate his hero.
Yeah.
A serial killer.
Yeah, just scaring people. You know, boys will be boys.
Yeah, okay.
What kind of
parents are those?
Jingles, for some reason, spares him.
Mm-hmm.
Is he kind of like the Predator, where he only targets, like, alpha male types?
Right, he just does not perceive him
as a
threat.
Woman or a child, it's like, I don't want your skull.
Right, or it's just he's so pathetic that it's like, did he feel bad?
I was wondering if Jingles like, felt did, a kinship or, with him, because Jingles feels like the type of guy who's had a pretty hard life.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe he was a model citizen before he joined the army, as fake nurse Rita will go on
Donna
deposit.
Chambers. Oh, yeah.
But I don't know. Like,
war will fuck you up.
He looks like a guy who might have been the butt of a lot of jokes. Might have been called wide load a time or two.
Mm.
So maybe he's got you know, wide load solidarity with this guy.
Or maybe he was planning to use him as his lookalike at the end. I don't
Jingles
know.
Jingles is playing 4D.
I'm taking all theories.
He's playing
4D chess.
Punji pit. 4D punji pit. Nurse Rita then tries to calm Brooke, who's in the parking lot, and she says it's been way too long. They should have been here by now. We should go and get help. But Rita accuses her of raying on the situation, which is the new hot word for bailing. Rita then relents, though, and says, well, maybe you should go, and gives her the keys to her cute yellow rabbit.
Rabbit.
And just as Brooke gets in and swears she'll be right back, stab with the hypo full of horse tranquilizer. Did you know that Nurse Rita is evil? Did you know that she's not even Nurse Rita?
Bum, bum, bum. Tell me there's going to be a flashback to explain this.
We're going
to
get a series of flashbacks to explain this. Flashback 1 week earlier, Nurse Rita, a.k.a. Donna Chambers, shows up at the Red Meadows Asylum to give a special treatment to Mr. Jingles. I think she's bluffing her way through this interview to portray herself as some kind of serial killer whisperer, because she's like, I've talked to Ted Bundy and arrested two confessions out of him. And the facility administrator is like, I didn't hear that. She's like, well, the feds are keeping it under wraps. And she goes off to mention every fucking serial killer you've ever heard of.
Yeah, she just rapid fires a couple of really currently relevant type of ones. Yeah, Ted Bundy, that was like less than 10 years from mm-hmm. this timeline. Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe that would work. It'd be impressive. I think you ask anybody that listens to true crime now and they could list off 10 more than that. But I think back in that time, I think Hopple could buy into that being...
Especially since Hopple would know, like, she'd recognize all those names. But my question is she like a Harley Quinn type who is actually a trained psychologist who's just lost her fucking mind? Or is she like a serial killer fangirl who is posing as a psychologist to do this for some kind of sick fantasy of hers?
I believe that it's kind of a combination, not a combination of those things. I think she's a real doctor that is trying to do, you know, she's kind of the equivalent of like one of the Nazi doctors, you know, doing experiments on that nobody else is willing to do because they're sick and fucked up. And she might find that to be helpful in studying the human mind, because nobody's going to suggest letting a serial killer just kill and watching them do it. But there could be knowledge to be gained here. So she's just the person who's brave and sick enough to do it.
Yeah, it was frustrating because in this flashback where they're revealing all of her hidden motivations inside the flashback, Mr. Jingles asks her, what do you want out of this? What's your damage? And she's like, oh, I've got my issues. And then she skillfully redirects it back to him. So it's like...
He said, who hurt you?
God damn it. Why do we have to have this mystery within a mystery? Can we just play with it now? No. I'm not going to complain yet because this is all fun. So I'm just going to let myself be led down the garden path.
I have my reasons.
Turns out Donna doesn't believe in evil. She believes the need to kill over and over comes from an outside circumstance. She turns off all the recording devices to gain his trust and then asks him if he ever hurt anyone before joining the army. And he says no. And she says since the mid-1970s, it's been an uptick in spree murders. Now, maybe more evil men are being born, but maybe it's the goddamn availability of pornography and the war in Vietnam. And then
high
fructose corn syrup
and the objectification of women. Don't forget about that.
I just love how he just chimes in with, he's got his own theory about why he's fucked up. Yeah. Fucking high fructose corn syrup, god damn it. Haven't killed anybody since I've been in this place, because I switched to Diet Coke. Or Tab. Tab would be the period.
Yeah.
Because they didn't even have Diet Coke in the early 80s, did they? When the fuck did Diet Coke get invented?
Sure, I don't know. They definitely had Diet Coke.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought the idea of a diet soda was kind of invented in the 80s, but maybe not. When the cocaine supply dried up, they had to figure out some other way to keep skinny. So
he has a very strong reaction to seeing Margaret Booth's picture in the newspaper.
Yes. I'm feeling like my theory that this is a disturbed man from Vietnam who had a lot of trauma and flashbacks, but was basically a decent person, was targeted by Margaret and had all of her actual murders blamed on him. And that's why he's a maniac now, I guess. That's my theory.
Diet Coke was unveiled in 1982.
And that's so many men have become deranged since then.
I feel like that scene, or I feel like maybe, I definitely think Margaret is involved in some way. That the hair flashback thing is what I keep going back to that makes me think she killed everyone for some reason. But the thing is, if he wasn't involved in the killing, then why would it come so natural to him 14 years later?
Because he's a Vietnam vet. I think he did some shit in Vietnam, for sure.
I mean, that's what I'm asking you. Do you think that he was involved with killing all of the people at the camp?
No. I actually think Margaret flipped that and went crazy. And what she's doing is trying to engineer a situation where she can do it again.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
If Jingles is there to do some kind of laboratory of evil, and Ramirez is there because Montana put it up for him for some reason.
That's what I'm saying. And if you aren't If I told you that you blacked out and you killed 14 people,
uh-huh.
and I said, do it comes natural, do you feel like now that you have that information that you would feel like it come killing would come easy to you? Because I still have my empathy in like my...
Again, I think this is a disturbed man. I just don't think he killed those kids. And I think he
maybe
probably...
after 14 years, that changed him too.
Yo, that's what I'm saying. Being wrongfully imprisoned, you know, for like the crimes you didn't commit.
Yeah.
And being fucked up by the crimes you committed in another country for, on the behest of your own country. Like, I could see... Yeah, that and 14 years to stew on it. Yeah. Plus, she gave him, it's like, that's the other thing, is like, these weren't acts of his own volition. She told him, you got to kill this orderly, you got to push this button, you got to do this.
But, I mean, all the people he's killed at the camp.
Yeah,
it's
no.
just like some those sick shit, like, oring that
he's
girl.
He's just working shit out. He's just combing what that, he's just trying out, see what happens naturally.
All right.
It's like, you know, if you're learning how to dance, he's got to, there's no wrong answers, just go out there and make yeah. some moves.
Yeah, well, you got to crack a few bunnies to get the formula right.
You do. I love, also there's this little element of like, Borg Queen seducing Data.
Yes.
Like he hasn't had a woman's touch in so long, and she's like, feel my soft hands. How many bunnies do you think were killed perfecting this cold cream? Uh-huh. That's all we're doing. We're killing bunnies, and hey, we might solve serial killers. It's like a fucking Thanos pitch, but if you're crazy like that, it kind of makes a certain sense, right? Anyway, flash forward, but
flashback.
Still a flashback from within the flashback. Donna meets the real Nurse Rita and her super cute yellow rabbit outside the Swayze Brothers service station. She gains her trust while Rita goes to use the bathroom. She then sneaks into the backseat of a rabbit, and Rita doesn't see her in broad daylight.
Mm-mm.
Despite approaching from the rear, despite like checking back over her shoulder to get the safety belt on.
Well, they did. Oh, well, I don't know. She's got that yellow shirt on, so she kind of just blends in with the cute car.
it's all yellow leather.
Yeah, and she did make a point of like looking back down the road while she was getting in the car. So she didn't quite look in the backseat. I don't know. Nurse Rita's tiny
saying,
too.
Like, I just, you know, this is a movie trope. But for real, have somebody just curl up in the back seat of your car in any configuration in broad daylight and see if you can pull it off.
Do you check your back seats ever when you're getting into your car?
No, but again, if I'm checking for large people hiding, like adult people, I don't think I'd have to check for that. It'd be like if a Wolverine was back there. I don't have to check for a Wolverine. It would just be there.
No, I'm just saying it was a popular urban legend.
Mm-hmm.
The flashing the brights thing. Mm-hmm. Have you heard that one?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, if someone flashes the brights, and you flash back, or they drive with the lights off, and they wait till someone flashes their lights to let them know they're on, then they target that person to kill them because fuck that person.
No. What's wrong with you?
What urban legend have you heard?
I'm talking about
you might have heard a different legend, but that is also an urban legend.
Okay.
So tell me your urban legend now.
The urban legend I'm thinking of is the one where there's someone's driving home and a car is following them and keeps flashing their brights and getting closer and closer. So they hurry home, and then they get out of their car and the person stops and says, oh, I was flashing my brights at you because every time I flash my brights, someone was getting up to stab you or something like
that. Yeah. Someone in the back.
However that works out.
Uh-huh.
And everyone lived and, you know, everyone went home. That person got help and got treatment and they're fine now. That's the kind of unicorn land I live in. I'm sure that's how it goes.
But
something like that.
Yeah.
I always compulsively check my back seats now because I have this like fear.
Is also like super like farsighted.
So maybe
like anything within like a 6-foot radius, she can't see, but she can see down the road all day long.
Mm-hmm.
She's like the reverse of the wide load jingles. Anyway, Rita's bopping down the road to the beat of Hall & Oates' Maneater when Donna chews her up, and that's her whole deal. Except for we don't know her whole deal because we don't know her true motivations. Part of her deal.
That was a great face she made when she sat up. She looked like a shark or the Cheshire Cat.
Oh yeah, it's great. Ray's still stuck in a pit. Chet still is passing out from loss of blood. So Ray takes this opportunity.
Oh, wait. Before that scene, there was a real quick Rita and Brooke scene there where she tells her that what she injected her with was horse tranquilizers that directly went to her legs.
Because that's why it's horse tranquilizers. It's designed specifically to work on legs.
Yeah, it just settles.
You got four horse legs. That's two more than a bipedal, so it's like, yeah, you got double leg numb.
Or at least she thinks so.
Yeah. So anyway, Ray takes this opportunity with Chet passing out to confess to some incredible things that happened, all stemming from a Hell Week hazing incident at this frat, which, of course, we're going to flashback to last year. There's been drinking. There's men grabbing each other's cocks. There's spanking of bare bottoms. You know, totally normal hetero guy stuff.
Yeah. Boys will be boys.
Ray finds a initiate, a pledge, Chan, who is not physically able to drink the amount of poison he's being asked to drink, especially, and he chides him and says, look, man, you gotta buck up, especially since as fellow minority, you have to work twice as hard to fit in half as well. And Ray says, look, I'm gonna give you 10 minutes to get it together. And Chan thanks him, but he's so drunk, he trips on the pants around his ankle, falls down a flight of stairs, apparently breaks his neck and dies.
Yeah. And Ray is a terrible nurse or whatever it is. He's actually an orderly.
Yeah.
Does that require any
they
medical training?
He was doing some medical training because like flunking out of college caused him to become an orderly instead of maybe a doctor or something.
So
yeah.
He seemed like he had been in college at least a while. I mean, he wasn't one of the pledges.
Right.
Or is that the pledge? Is pledge the word for someone newly being initiated?
I think so.
Okay.
It's in pledge, initiated. I don't know when, but they're clearly not.
He clearly
yet.
Wasn't a pledge. So at least, let's say at least 1 year he was there.
Who, Ray? Ray's a junior.
Ray's a junior.
Yes.
And Ray can't even do the minimum to see if something's alive or not.
Yeah. I guess this isn't med school, though, right? This is like pre-med.
I don't want to speak ill
like
of any
I'm
orderlies
doctor,
out there, but
I
assume that by the way Ray's playing it, uh-huh. It requires no medical training.
One of his white frat brothers comes up, like, bro, what do we do, bro? And he's like, bro, relax, bro. I've
the
got
pledge
this.
Master. The subtitles told us
pledge master.
Yeah.
Holy shit, that sounds cool.
I know. So
the pledge master 3.
And this,
even more cock, even more elephant walks. Elephant walk. Pledge master 3. Elephant walk. There, finally. It took me 3 takes, but I
yeah.
got it.
And the pledge master's dad is a senator or something, so he can't have this body on his hands.
Yeah. So Ray's like, hey, I'm gonna quote unquote take care of it. And he's gonna do that by staging an auto accident where Chan goes over a cliff. Hilariously, Chan wakes up and says, what's going on? Just as Ray's about to roll him over the cliff. Manages to snatch his watch and take it with him to the grave.
Not only that, but he does like 3 gouges
yeah.
down his arm.
I'm thinking it's not the watch, it's the DNA under
yeah.
the dude's fingernails that's going to get you, dude.
Yeah.
But the guilt over this heinous act kind of just degrades the tank and ruins his scholastic career, which is why he's got the shitty orderly job. Anyway, Ray thought he got away with it, but then the cops found Chan's car a couple days ago, which means it's only a matter of time before they tie him to the murder. So this whole camp thing is him just getting out of L.A. to plot his Jesse Pinkman escape to Alaska and live in the woods and never speak to another living soul from Breaking Bad plot. His El Camino, if you would.
This interesting.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting. Because I'm not sure why they needed to tell us that Ray was a huge asshole. Someone getting drunk
because
and falling down.
All right, dude, until this episode, and there's a
right.
lot of heavy shit he had to do.
Someone getting drunk and falling down the stairs at a pledge frat party is so believable, and it's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
So I don't know why they don't just call the police.
Because I imagine a murder over this kind of over drinking. I mean, this is the kind of shit that gets fraternities deregistered, like get shut down.
Sure.
Like
yeah.
initiate dies because of over drinking and all this jackassery that everyone says is you're supposed. I mean,
but that shit still happens today. Is my point.
Oh yeah.
And
I'm
like in
that,
the 80s,
but you call the cops and it would be bad, especially if your frat master or your pledge master is a goddamn senator son. Like,
well, then even more reason why it'll never get out.
I'm not saying this isn't reprehensible behavior, but the
no,
problem
I mean,
is
no, I don't want to break it down like that. I'm just listing things here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That I think are shitty for Ray.
Yeah.
And he's just an irredeemable asshole. However,
uh-huh. Well, Donna
3 days ago,
irredeemable evil asshole.
Three days ago, they found the car, and yesterday,
uh-huh.
he was having fun in his workout class. So,
yeah.
Are you really that upset? So why my point is, why give Ray all this like impetus and backstory if you're just gonna kill him at the end? I don't think he's dead.
How in the fuck is he not dead?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know yet, but we'll figure
it
out.
Is it going to be like, I would honestly, I would love a Sleepy Hollow Ray on that fucking motorcycle.
That was just his...
Like, with a flaming skull head? Yeah. Yeah. Can he be holding a pumpkin?
Yeah.
He has a pumpkin helmet.
He's like...
come back as a Ghost Rider.
Ooh, that's good. Or it's like the Prestige, and that's where all the Jonas keeps coming from. They just have a bunch of Jonas.
About the
they have
time
a cloning
loop.
Machine. Yeah.
Oh, my
time
God.
Loop.
Ray could be stuck in a time loop now.
Yep.
Okay. I still want him to have a pumpkin helmet, but the time loop can work too.
We're taking all theories here.
Also, you'll never get this. You'll never believe this, guys, but Chet actually wasn't passed out, and he's heard this entire confession, which causes Ray to bone out of that pit and leave Chet at the bottom of it, still impaled, which, wow, this guy just saved you. But you're at a pretty deep moral punji pit yourself, so I guess it's really easy to just add one more stake to it.
Right. Climbs right out of there with his shredded muscles.
Shredded tendons, wrists, giant cut on his hand. He's just climbs out like Spider-Man. I will say that every time someone climbs in or out of this punji pit, it's a moment.
It really is.
Like, it seems like almost everybody kind of slips and they play like these violent strings, and then there's like ominous horns, and you just feel like if any time someone could trip and fall.
Yeah.
Anyway, Trevor, Montana, and Xavier, Trevor is being as noble as
which
Ray is.
Which I call them the A squad. This is my favorite group.
For sure. He's as noble as Ray is Craven, wanting to rescue Margaret and Birdie. I love Montana's like, who the fuck is Birdie? And he's like, Chef Birdie is good people. He's good people.
He's good people.
Chef Birdie's just good. She good people, Cecily. Jingle shows up and the kids flee to the boathouse. They find the real nurse Rita tied up and under tarps, and she doesn't understand what the fuck is going on, just that there's more people here, and she screams and gets away, but she runs right into Jingles, and he kills her by impaling her face with an oar.
She got O-A-R'd.
She did. She's D-O-A-R'd, dead on arrival of a rafting piece of equipment.
Yes. I'm really glad that they figured out immediately that there were two Ritas. Not, oh, that's weird. Her name is Rita also.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Does Nurse Rita's uniform seem dated?
Are
they still wearing that in the 80s?
You watch a lot of 70s stuff, and I always remark about how like fetish gear looking the nurses look. And at some point, they went from that to Scrubs, and it happened fucking overnight. I feel like every doctor and nurse is just like, why are we bothering to wear clothes?
Yeah.
We can just wear these pajamas.
Why are we
the
wearing
doctors can throw a coat over it and let's call it good.
Right.
But like, I'm not sure when it happened, so like maybe this is that missing link between the fetish gear nurse with the, you know, the little hat that has a red cross on it and the white pumps, and this is just like the transition form between that and just full-on Scrubs. All right, so Trevor, Montana, and Xavier, the A squad, reunite with Ray,
the shit squad,
solidly on the Z squad. Ray is of course full on Private Hudson from Aliens mode, just game over, man's bug out at every opportunity. Trevor offers to let him and Montana use the bike to go help while Xavier and Trevor go rescue Chet, but he warns them, this bike is a fickle mistress. Go easy on the throttle, she'll buck you like a wild stallion, which. I mean, I'm sympathetic to a guy mixing his metaphors, but like, is it a mistress? Is it a she? Is it a stallion? Is this some kind of trans horse?
It's all of those things.
All right,
I'm living for Trevor.
On brand, yeah. Trevor is rapidly emerging as the hero, and Xavier, his trusty sidekick,
just like his gigantic cock, just, rapidly emerging.
It's rapidly like a. Like an airbag deploying, it just there, millisecond response time. Speaking of Chet, his screams and moans are drawing jingle jangly type attention. X and T, as I like to call them.
That's exactly what my notes say. XT find C.
XT find C. Chet, I did not know this about him. Maybe this is another side effect from steroids. Ugly crier. I'm just going to say it.
You think so?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he looked pretty good.
Not attractive. Not it doesn't sound good, doesn't look good. It's like John Hamm crying on Saturday Night Live. who climbs? They climb down to the punji pit, which again, super exciting. Chet tells Xavier about Ray's cowardice and his other serious fucking issues. Xavier pulls Chet off the stake. Trevor helps him out of the pit, which, again, this Punji stuff, very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since Jingles is approaching him. There's a lot of, like, there's a ticking clock in the situation.
Mm-hmm.
They manage to escape just in time, but they're able to see Jingles approach the clearing and look down into the pit. Trevor thinks he can take him.
Mm-hmm.
It's one knife versus two guns.
These guns.
Wow. And he goes to bum rush him.
I love it. Xavier's reaction there is you can see him mouth, what the fuck?
Yes, he's doing the slapping his guns. He shoulder charges Jingles, knocks him into his punji pit, and yells, "Welcome to your own petard, asshole."
So good.
Except it wasn't Jingles. It was the asthmatic wide load imposter Jingles. No.
Yes. And then we have, okay, so I have those three lines written down. Which one's the best from Trevor?
Okay.
The final one was, "Just so we're all clear, that wasn't Jingles."
I mean, the
he's
petard.
So good. The petard is my favorite.
Either Bucking Stallion or the petard.
Not the guns?
Yeah.
Petard's my favorite, too.
Especially since, like, isn't that something you hoist someone? Like, falling into a pit's the opposite of that. I'm not clear what a petard is. I've lived my whole life, 43 years. I don't know what a fucking petard is.
Just
petard,
use the phrase.
A small bomb made of metal or wooden box filled with power used to blast down a door or to make a hole in the wall? What the fuck? Shakespeare's phrase, "hoist with his own petard," is an idiom which means to be harmed by one's own plan to harm someone else or to fall into one's own trap, implying that one could be lifted, blown upwards by one's own bomb, or in other words, be foiled by one's own plan. I think Trevor is, like, well-read on Shakespeare.
He knows more about this than we do.
As if to fall into one's own trap. Trevor, you are revealing hidden facets.
Wow, that's
that
incredible.
I find very attractive in a man.
Yeah.
It's
kind of warm in here.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
So meanwhile, the Night Stalker is confronting Ray and Montana in the parking lot. Ray once again abandons yet another companion to almost certain doom.
That's what I mean. All of this is unprompted. You can give her time to get on that motorcycle.
But
it works that he didn't.
It's,
but
you know, half seconds to lose. And he's just bombing down this cabin camp road, Tom Cruise and Top Gunning it. And then Jingle steps out of the forest and fucking beheads him.
Yeah.
And here's where I like the headless bikeman. His bike rode headless down the road, and it was a really kind of cool effect of, like, the headless corpse kind of steering it until the bike loses its momentum and falls over. Telling you, I need a jack-o'-lantern helmet.
Yeah. I love that you're very much on board. The Ray is alive in some capacity.
Oh, I don't think he's alive. I think he's undead. That's a very clear difference here.
Very clear. Also, I want to point out here that every time you saw Jingles, I was prepared for it to be like, that's Booth in there, or that's someone else. And they always resolve it immediately. So I appreciate that. You know, as soon as, because he approaches in the shadow and they don't show Jingles' face,
mm-hmm.
like they're going to conceal it, that he turns around and ends up being him.
Yeah. With all, I mean, you know, remarkable restraint shown by the American Horror Story writer's room for mm-hmm. not having all these potential false Jingles. And they don't really fuck with this as much as they could have.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Of course, maybe with in the night to come, there's going to be four or five more that conveniently provide jump scares and false flags and et cetera.
Actually, I just talked
about petards to be hoisted on.
Well, I think I just thought of something else to that point. They have to do some sort of special trickery in order to make his face appear that dark on the film, right? Does he wear like something black over his face so that's all cast in shadow?
Yeah.
And then when he turns around, he definitely doesn't have that much shadow from the raincoat. I mean, it barely covers his forehead.
True.
So why are they adding that extra bit of tension that they resolve immediately?
I don't know.
I just talked myself out of that being cool.
See, you're thinking too much about it.
All right, let's move on.
Night Soccer continues to menace Montana with a knife, and she shoves him. And then she pulls him in close and passionately kisses him. Then she bites his mouth and demands, "Why the hell haven't you killed her yet?" Smash to black.
Bum,
end of episode.
Bum, bum.
Now, you pointed out when we cut back to the Night Stalker menacing Montana, she's like, "Oh, I think she's going to hand him his ass because she's got a switchblade."
Hell yeah.
We were like, "Oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. She's in peak physical condition from her jazzercise."
Yeah.
She's loaded with cocaine. She's got a switchblade. She's going to fuck him up.
Mm-hmm.
He's fuck withable too. Hell, I mean, yeah. Chet threw him like a bale of hay.
Yeah, and Brooke knocked him out with an oar.
Yeah.
A couple minutes ago.
Yeah, he's sometimes hilariously inept with his own knife. I'm like, I got Montana in this fight.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then this happens.
Yeah.
So, like, a couple things.
Who's the her?
It's got to be Brooke.
Brooke or Margaret Booth.
Why would you hire him to kill Margaret Booth? I don't know. See, we don't know. Yeah, you're right. That's perfectly reasonable. It could be, Chef Birdie.
Right, could be Chef Birdie. Could be Nurse Rita?
Not Nurse Rita, because she would know that there's been some kind of switcheroo.
I definitely think it's... I really do think it's supposed to be Brooke.
The other thing is, we found out, despite looking like she had made an impact, it doesn't seem like the Night Stalker really gave much heed to Margaret Booth's admonition not to kill anyone and to find...
Right. He immediately goes to the infirmary and is like, "I'm going to kill you, bitch." Wait, that's not what you said
you were going to do?
He
wanted her to post feet. She didn't.
She didn't.
So he's under no obligation to hold his end of the bargain.
Did we see Margaret Booth once in this episode?
I don't think so.
Okay.
She has nowhere to be found.
Okay,
maybe
so...
Maybe she's off doing the... Like, next week is going to be a bottle episode with her and the ghost.
Mm-hmm.
Ghost Jonah. Yeah. Jonas?
Gonus.
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 Jost.
Here's a theory that's going to drive you wild.
Oh.
Is Montana related to Margaret Booth?
No.
Why?
They have none of the same essence.
That's exactly what you'd expect from people working together to kill people. I don't know why I wrote that down, but we're taking on all theories here.
It's funny that like there's very few people at this cabin that don't have an agenda.
Right. There's...
Like, Xavier's trying to get away from his porn pimp. Brooke was running from the Night Stalker.
Right. So if we trace this back, Montana and the Night Stalker knew each other before he broke into Brooke's apartment and took only her wedding ring and then said, "Satan will show him the way." And then she joins Brooke.
Is Montana Satan?
Or Montana. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great theory right there. I think it's canon now.
Yeah, I'm trying to think who... So, like, Brooke is there without an agenda. Trevor might be there without an agenda. Chet, I think, is probably there without an agenda. Well, he's got an agenda, so he doesn't want to be in town with the Olympics.
But not quite an agenda. Just a good reason.
Chef Birdie, we don't know, has an agenda. Everybody else that's at this camp has... And then Trevor, we don't know whether he's got it or not. He seems true blue, but that's exactly what you do with the villain in this case.
Right.
But, you know, that's the other thing is, like, a lot of people, the evidence that people are pointing towards, like, things being stagey or simulated, I think can be just retroactively work because it's all these people, in fact, supporting different factions of serial killers. So, like, a lot of things that felt, like, stagey or coincidental or, like, in plot, you know, like, there's people saying... That something's fishy about Nurse Rita not being able to find her keys last episode. And we made the joke. It's like, well, it's just Jingles just jacked her keys. That's what he does.
Right.
Nah, that stuff all has a reasonable explanation. You just have to listen, watch 30 minutes of flashbacks to get it. So,
yeah, we got some feedback that talks a little bit about that.
What if? Oh my God. What if Brooke? No, she wouldn't recognize that, because I'm thinking, like, I'm trying to think of why Montana would have it in for Brooke. And, like, what if she was, like, made fun of at fat camp by Brooke? But I'm like, why would Brooke be at fat camp? Or if she was, would she be like, oh, my God, samesies. We were at the same fat camp. Why did she have it in? She didn't respond to her advances at the...
Because
the sequence
is
she shows up to the class. Montana meets her. Nightstalker breaks in that night.
Yeah.
So, like, it's they imply that Montana just had it in to kill her from first sight.
I don't know. Maybe she's just the sadistic type of person who just really likes tormenting people. I mean, imagine that her wedding story got out and was probably big news in the area. So
that's true.
Maybe they just targeted her just because of the whole wedding thing. Because that's something that's happened before in American Horror Story and Murder House. A group of people came in and, like, reenacted
the
nurse killings.
Uh-huh.
So maybe that's a kind of a thing. But Richard Ramirez is a real life serial killer.
Right.
Maybe they're going to say that he had a hidden accomplice and nobody ever knew about that's still out there today. Flashback.
And then a flash forward. And Billy Lord's just killing fools as a middle-aged woman.
Yeah.
I could get down with that.
Could
wearing
you?
Mom jeans. She's got a little bit of, like, you know, 50-year-old woman makeup on.
Yeah.
All right. Do we have feedback?
We have.
People could send to ahs@baldmove.com. Just three little letters, AHS.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ampersand, eight more little letters, a period, and then final three, and you're there. You're home. It's easy.
Yeah.
So easy. Also, we have weekly threads on the forums, forums.baldmove.com. Cecily, what are the people saying?
Well, the people have much to say. We've got only a few emails, but they are long.
Okay.
People have a lot to say here.
Starting with
Autumn. When you were talking about the Richard Ramirez backstory thing, and especially the shooting in the ant face part, that part is actually pretty accurate to the real guy. Last podcast on the left, episodes 110 and 111 are all about Richard Ramirez, if you are interested. I did some brushing up. As an aside, do listen to Last Podcast on the Left regularly. It's been a while. I think they're like 300s in their episodes now.
Holy moly.
So it's been a while since I've listened to that one. But yeah, I do remember that those are.
I doubt that's the last podcast on the left. And there's a lot of podcasts past that one. There's 300.
You know,
there's the last podcast subdivision on the left. You can pull in there. It's kind of a net. It's kind of a maze. There's like hundreds of houses. You'll find your way around.
Yeah. Do you know that three last podcasts on the left equal last podcast on the right?
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
All right. He actually, she continues. He actually suffered two concussions, not just the one in American Horror Story. I don't know about the poisoning in the womb part, but I guess it could possibly be true. You also asked about Richard Ramirez's weird Satanism thing. He apparently was a big fan of AC/DC and Judas Priest and really took their lyrics about hell and Satan and stuff to heart, at least according to his statements. He was a weird, unhinged guy.
See, that's the thing.
Blame the music.
The exception that proves the rule that, like, pop music and video games and stuff don't really affect people? Or was he just saying that? Because I feel like sometimes when people say that, it's like they're intentionally leaning into what the public wants to believe to gain sympathy. It's not my fault. It's this fucking music that that my parents let me listen to and that you let me consume because you approved it to go out in stores. You know, it's kind of like society's to blame, not me.
Right. Because just like the Beatles album, which I forget what it's called,
Helter Skelter.
The one that influenced Charles Manson. You know, they blame the music, but it is kind of what you make of it. Like, maybe it's a music's fault, but because you were already unhinged and they took meaning from it that was their own and acted upon it.
Well, it's like the other guy that, like, stalked Jodie Foster because she was in Taxi Driver. Like,
right.
Sometimes crazy people just get inspired by crazy things, and it's not the fault of the artist or the person. So even if Richard Ramirez is True Blue, oh, yeah, Judas Priest, AC/DC made me worship the devil and kill people. So what? He could have done that watching Care Bears.
Right, exactly.
You know, he really took a shine to Skeletor watching He-Man, and then,
Autumn continues, I'm a huge believer in the simulation theory after hearing it on your show. Well, wait till she listens to this fucking episode. It's going to blow your mind, all the theories we came up with. I wasn't sure about it at first, but after the hyper hiker weirdness, especially I Don't Die Here, I have converted and think that might be the direction they go. Back on Margaret for a moment.
Hiker is like a glitch in the Matrix?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
I agree that Margaret is super suspicious. I think she will definitely be talking about the Jesus stuff every episode to beat us over the head with it. Because
we've got to break this episode.
Yeah. Having grown up in a religious cult, I love Aaron's hot takes on religion in this podcast. It definitely seems like a commentary on certain types of people when she had her whole God is great because you can do horrible things speech, and frankly, I'm kind of here for it. Yeah, I don't know if you talk about this every once in a while. I don't know if our American Horror Story listeners are quite familiar, but you have a religious culty background yourself. Mm-hmm. And
Raised as a Satanist. I was raised as a Jehovah's Witness.
They have
very interesting beliefs.
It's a very interesting resource to tap into for these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. I do know my Bible. Read it many, many times through.
Mm-hmm.
Got a lot of interesting stuff in it. A lot of solid stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of silly, weird, fucked up stuff. And I like to celebrate it all.
God made Ryan Murphy special.
That's true. That's true.
By the way, after a rewatch, Margaret definitely had brunette pigtails in the flashback scene. So we went and watched, before this podcast, went and watched the first episode again, the scene where she tells her story.
Yeah, put in the effort.
Yeah, she's definitely
up on the DVR.
She's definitely got long blonde hair and looks like a different person than Jonas flashbacks and remembers as having two brunette pigtails covered in blood and upright.
Another glitch in the simulation?
No, she's guilty of something. One last thing.
Dyeing her hair.
I have suspicions still about Brooke. When her fiance was having his breakdown and talking about seeing the best man at her place, she mentions, you know how scared I am. I get at night and I didn't want to see you before the wedding. I feel like that hints back at something else in her past. Why else get scared alone at night before the night stalker and the wedding incident? I guess we will see how much Ryan Murphy and crew address those loose ends, but I have hopes for something more to be there. Maybe Brooke is somehow related to Mr. Jingles, and this is part of her dark past. Probably not, but taking all theories, right? Right. No wrong answers.
I don't know. I feel like I've cooled off on the simulation theory after this episode, because I just feel like
You don't want a Pumpkinhead simulation?
No, I mean, that's not a simulation. That's a ghost time portal loop, which is very distinct. That's a reasonable theory, unlike the bullshit simulation theory now.
Simulation theory is over.
Ghost pumpkin rider time loop theory, solid. Simulation theory, busted.
Yeah.
Sorry, we just got to get on board with the pumpkin time loop.
I have an email here from Rachel. And it's a long one. And I'm sorry, Rachel, I did edit this quite a bit because I have to try to make it fit somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But she did a very detailed breakdown of the timeline of events.
Oh.
And about where things should be in the real time if we were following those rules at all.
Did she document each and every flashback?
Yeah.
All right.
She says, I have a present punishment for you. Because I'm a maniac and a glutton for punishment, I actually tried to piece together a timeline of the longest night ever. Here we go.
Sounds like punishment to me.
I'm cutting that. The things that are bolded are fact. Okay, you can't see that. Should have cut that part a little bit. are presented as true on the show. I only found one thing, the timing of the replay of the Olympic torch lighting, that's a true impossibility, but the whole sequence of events unfolding in record time is improbable, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
July 28th, 1984 was a Saturday, so the plan to leave after class could mean a lot of things, but it's a two-hour drive, presumably north from LA to the camp. Olympic opening ceremonies on that day were from 5 to 8 p.m. Pacific time. It was scheduled for 5 to 9 p.m. Pacific. My best guess is they aired commentary right after and would have started the replay no earlier than 9 p.m., probably later. I want to say it starts around 10 p.m. in the timeline of American Horror Story, but Horror Story also condenses its running time. So the torch lighting was at 7:45. The announcer notes that the sun is still up.
Mm-hmm.
The sunset is 7:57, so full dark would be at 9:07.
Full dark.
So pre-7:57 sunset, the counselors hit Jonas, meet Margaret, and tour the camp. Then the campfire scene appears to take place in full dark, but let's allow some license and say it could have started right at sunset, given that between 7:57 and 10:40, we have Mr. Jingles escapes, the marshmallow story time, marshmallow campfire story time, Brooke checking on Jonas in the infirmary, counselors are hanging out, and then Trevor shows up. Trevor and Montana go skinny dipping. Dr. Hopple arrives at the asylum. Roy, the mechanic, is killed. The counselors turn on the replay of the Olympic ceremonies at that time. Roy's truck and Mr. Jingles show up at the camp. Brooke finds dead Jonas. The Jingles chases her through the mud while the torch lighting is happening.
Mm-hmm.
She says, even if the replay started right at 8:30, which would put the replay of the Parade of Nations overlapping with the first few bullet points in the sequence, that would force this scene to take place around 11:15. Brooke takes the other counselors to investigate the infirmary and Margaret tells her to clean up. Using off-screen time, Brooke takes the shower, dries, and styles her hair. Brooke answers the payphone.
That's a brisk 5 minutes, right?
Yeah. Dr. Hopple arrives at the camp. Hopple leaves and is killed by Jingles. Then the news in the cabin says, tonight at 11, a brutal murder at a gas station.
Okay, so we're still not... So this takes place between 10:30 and 11 o'clock?
Yes.
Okay. Or 10:45 that you mentioned.
It should be after 11:15.
Okay.
Right now.
45 minutes. Okay. We got some time to work with then.
But the news says tonight at 11. So it's already after 11. But the news says it's before 11. So Margaret says lights out in exactly 20 minutes. So to give us the most time allowable, it's now 10:40 PM. Montana and Brooke trade trauma stories. Montana kisses Brooke and Brooke goes outside. Between 10:40 and 11, the guys go to the showers and Xavier goes back for his towel. All of the above took place within 2 hours and 43 minutes if we're being super generous, and 1 hour and 33 minutes if we care about Twilight. Then after 11, we get Xavier with his daddy and daddy dying.
Oh God.
Brooke being confronted by Ramirez. Ramirez killing Jonas. Nurse Rita is attacked by Jingles. Brooke tells Montana about Ramirez while he watches them. Ramirez kills Jonas again. Ray calls for help, and everyone gathers around the daddy's body. They hear Jingles. They run to the van. Margaret and Ramirez have a heart-to-heart. They almost hit Nurse Rita and crash. Montana, Xavier, and Trevor go to the cabin. Nurse Rita, Brooke, Ray, and Chet go to the infirmary, and Margaret encounters Jonas. This isn't even including all the timelines from this episode.
Uh-huh.
So... I guess it's around midnight in real time.
So, yeah.
You think every episode maybe takes place over the course of like an hour?
If it's just in real time. I mean, obviously there's flashbacks and stuff, so.
Yeah. This night will never end. Okay. Next email is from Eric. Eric, by the way, I'm Eric from Cleveland, not Eric from Seattle. I guess we called him that in the first week.
Oh, well, guess what?
You're going to Cleveland
Seattle,
to see
Eric is
going to
be in Cleveland. Worlds collide. Holy shit. Don't cross your streams, bro. Trying to make it back alive.
Eric says, This season so far is pretty entertaining. I think the episodes are getting better by the week. The twists and turns were unexpected, and I don't know how I feel about them. The Nurse Rita twist was great. I just don't want them to humanize Jingles quite yet, or at all, unless the other villains, at this point there's too many to count, can live up to how cool Jingles is. I was sad to see Ray die so early in the season, just after they gave us his backstory. Well, it's not for long. Also, the other black guy was killed off, and the other person of color is evil, as far as we know. I wish AHS did not follow these tropes. So I was thinking that they maybe leaned pretty heavily into Ray being an asshole and abandoning people, because that's sort of a complete flip of the classic black guy tropes in movies. Or in horror movies, especially.
Yeah, but they still, like, you know, one of them's, like they said,
except that he did still die.
One's dead, so unless he's caught in some kind of time loop. So, because honestly.
No, I'm not saying they did it well. Yeah.
When he showed up, I'm like, well, this is just literally 80s trope if they kill him. And it's also, like, not one of the fun tropes. You know, it's kind of one of the, like, oh, this is kind of lame tropes. So maybe in their minds, if they do bring him back in the great simulation time traveling great pumpkin head motorcycle Ray adventure of next episode, then they can be like, aha, we subverted your non-subversion. But yeah, that's fair. If it's just, if they're playing this straight, that's definitely a fair criticism, and a surprising one, because I feel like, you know, American Horror Story, it has many, many sins, but, like, you know, fucking up, like, gender and race and sexual stuff is not super, it's not perfect by any stand, but it's like, it definitely tries, I think.
You know what? I just thought of another stereotype they're leaning into, which is pretty surprising. And that is, I didn't voice this before, but I'm really bummed out that Montana's a bad guy now, because she was part of the A Squad.
Yeah.
And she was also protested against being a lesbian and then ended up being at least bisexual. Well, definitely bisexual now that she hit on Montana, or not Montana, on Brooke and Ramirez. Mm. So it's also kind of like an evil gaze trope. You know, the daddy who's trying to blackmail Xavier, and then Montana being evil. So
yeah, and the fake Nurse Rita is also black and trans, so you've got like a double.
Right. Yes. The only people I trust now are Xavier, Big Dick Dude, and Brooke. Who the hell knows where the season is going? I just hope they don't create too many twists that they can't tie up neatly before the 10 episodes is up.
Well,
yeah.
you can hope in one hand and watch AHS in the other and see which runs out first, I guess.
Yeah. It's a great episode. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Again, if you want to send feedback, you can send it to ahs@baldmove.com. Talk with your fellow fans on the forums, baldmove.com. And we will see you next week.